Okay, people, episode 25, halfway to 50, get in, and I'm in Australia. Fits well because today we have Mr. Nick Kemp. Nick Kemp is a leading Ikigai researcher and educator who has spent over 4 years studying the concept full time. He hosts the Ikigai Tribe podcast and works closely with Japan's top Ikigai scholars to debunk Western myths and teach the true cultural meaning of Ikigai. What if you've been searching for a purpose using a broken map? In this episode, we unpack how the Western world misunderstands Ikigai and why the viral Venn diagram is more harmful than helpful. We explore how Ikigai is actually a feeling, one rooted in small joys, meaningful roles, and being present with what matters. Why do so many people confuse money with meaning? How can we build roles that align with our values rather than external validation? And what happens when we turn purpose into a productivity trap? You'll walk away with a clearer, more grounded understanding of what gives life meaning. Whether it's through craft, connection, or contribution, this conversation will help you redefine success on your own terms and start noticing where fulfillment already lives in your day. All right, let's get into it. Oh yeah, wait a second. The many producers of the show, so just practically me, because we definitely have some, have told me to like, subscribe, rate the show, all that stuff. Anyway, here's the intro music. Nick, what has the West got so wrong about Ikigai?
It's got a few crucial things wrong, and they largely came from a best-selling book. And this book's a great read. It's inspiring. And, I mean, it's a bestseller, so people love what they read in the book. I guess the biggest thing we're getting wrong about Ikigai is this idea it's the sweet spot of this Venn diagram. And you'll see this on social media. Everyone posting about how great it is. And, oh, there's this amazing Japanese concept that if you're doing something you love, you're good at, that the world needs and that you can be paid for, that's your Ikigai. So that's fundamentally wrong. This is actually the purpose Venn diagram, and someone simply removed purpose from the center and put in Ikigai, and it went viral. So rather than being a sweet spot, Ikigai is more like a spectrum, and it's all the things that make your life worth living, from small joys to relationships to meaningful challenges. It can be even things you don't like, you know, but that help you grow. Then there's the idea it's from Okinawa, and that's not the case. It's a common Japanese word. And there are actually other words that have the suffix gai. So a far more common word is yarigai, which means things worth doing. So Japanese will say yarigai ga aru ne, like, oh, that's worth doing. So if I say, hey, I'm going to learn how to play the shakuhachi or the guitar, yeah, a Japanese friend might go, and that's sort of saying, oh, good for you, or yeah, that's worth pursuing. Then there's the romantic longevity link that also came from, I guess, this book and also the Netflix series. Ikigai does encourage healthy behaviors, so things like exercise or spending time with people. So that could aid to some degree in longevity, but it's obviously not going to guarantee that you'll live to be 100. And for some people, their Ikigai can be like a coping mechanism. So it can be alcohol. And, you know, I don't know about you, but when I was younger, you know, going out to have drinks with my mates was like a source of Ikigai. It was great. I really enjoyed it. So even unhealthy practices can be a source of Ikigai because it feels good, or you're socially bonding over a few beers. And that's probably not going to help you live longer, but you'll enjoy life more. So it's sort of those three things, this Venn diagram, and it's the idea, it's a sweet spot, and these romantic notions. It's from Okinawa, and it's the secret to a long and happy life. This is a very Western romantic interpretation of the concept.
Not to say no one's purpose is drinking a beer. You know, if you like a Guinness, go for it. But what is the distinction, do you think, between the purpose piece and things that are worth doing?
Okay, so if we're going back to yarigai, like what's worth doing, that's very practical and immediate. So you could think, oh, tomorrow's my day off. What's worth doing? I could watch Netflix and just laze about, or, oh, you know, I want, there's some Japanese study I could do. I could practice guitar. I could exercise. So those things are worth doing. They would come under yarigai. Ikigai is more kind of philosophical, and it's something that feels worth doing. That's something you feel. So ikigai is something you feel that gives you a sense of purpose, that brings you joy, that makes you feel connected. So it's very subjective. It's going to be different to all of us. We might have some common sources of ikigai that we share. But, I mean, we should start off with this distinction or this definition of ikigai that came from Japan's pioneering researcher, this amazing woman called Kamiya Miyako, she actually worked with lepers who were ostracized from mainland Japan. They were shipped off to islands. And she had this working definition of ikigai, that you have ikigai sources, so that could be hobbies, relationships, roles, aspects of your work, goals, even memories. And then you have ikigai kan, with kan meaning feeling or perception or awareness. And so your ikigai sources would help you feel ikigai kan. So it's what makes you feel that life is worth living. So it's that excitement maybe before you go and watch a football game, or, you know, and the moment when you, like, isn't it amazing? You go to a football game, you think your team's going to lose, and somehow they win, and your state is completely changed. You celebrate, you're screaming with your mates, you feel great. But if you lose, you feel, horrible, you're devastated. So that's a good example. We can have this ikigai experience when our team wins in a nail biter at the football. It's can be intimacy when you connect with someone, you know, you hug someone or you have a meaningful discussion. But it's something you feel, not something you chase or achieve.
It's not something you chase. And I've always thought ikigai is just a guide on how you get to a certain destination. But you're saying we can achieve ikigai right now.
Yeah, I mean, this could be a source of ikigai, a meaningful discussion where we've only just met, but we already feel, you know, we're being kind of friendly and playful. We feel connected. You're coming to Sydney. And I'm already thinking, yeah, I'd like to meet you in person. That's kind of what ikigai is, these feelings, making new friends or having a kind of like an emotion, it's kind of like an intellectual intimacy we're probably going to have on this call. We're going to share ideas, thoughts, we'll learn from each other. And it kind of makes our evening or your morning worth it. It's like, oh, this evening's worth it for me because I had a meaningful conversation.
What do you think is so dangerous about the West definition right now?
I think it makes it very heavy, and it puts this pressure on you thinking, well, you know, it has to be something I'm good at and I have to make money from it, and it in some way has to serve the world. So that's already putting this pressure. What if you're a terrible dancer and you just love dancing, or you're a bad singer but you love singing? Why can't that be something worthwhile? Like, it might be painful for other people to watch or listen to. It puts this pressure on a concept that really should be very intuitive, and it's more social. There is this, tends to be this social dynamic to ikigai. It's like ikigai is kind of better shared with others when you go out to dinner with friends, or you go to the football with a friend. I'm sure it's more enjoyable when you go and watch a game of footy with a friend rather than by yourself. Your role can be a very strong source of ikigai. It gives you a sense of purpose, meaning you can express yourself. So it's more relatable to positive psychology. And I don't think I've ever heard any positive psychologist saying, oh, happiness or everything that's important in your life comes down to a sweet spot. You know, they don't talk like that. They say, oh, you find it in different areas of your life, and they usually emphasize, you know, relationships and having a sense of, you know, belonging. So Ikigai is very multifaceted, multidimensional, but it's also very subjective. So it's unique. You know, what our Ikigai is will be unique to all of us. Probably that the problem with the word Ikigai is there are no plurals in Japanese. So they don't have Ikigais. So this might be... That's the problem as to why people might think there's...
It's a singular point.
You only
point.
Can have one Ikigai. And you can have... You know, you can have goals, like meaningful goals that are, you know, ambitious in nature. That can be sources of Ikigai. But it's more about who you become, pursuing them, the journey... And they should have this strong intrinsic element to them, not just extrinsic, where it's, you know, I have to achieve this goal and make this certain amount of money, or, you know, climbing a mountain is an interesting one because the whole point is to try and get to the summit. But, I mean, a lot goes on, the preparation, the planning, coming down. And so it's more than just getting to the top. And the top is this fleeting moment of maybe ecstasy. And, I mean, could you imagine the nightmare of climbing Mount Everest? You finally get there. You have this moment of ecstasy. I've made it. But you've got to make it down. You hear these stories of some people, literally, they're dying on the mountain. Some people choose to ignore them, walk over them, and continue walking, while others say, no, I can't leave this person to die. I would take them down. So that would be a choice of Ikigai, like, oh, saving this person is more important than my personal dream of climbing the mountain, whereas some would say, too bad, guy knew the risks. We all know the risks, but climbing the mountain for me is more important. So Ikigai is this subjective thing, what makes our life worth living. And it's not always like a positive thing. Someone's Ikigai could be, you know, alcohol or... I remember one of my favorite quotes from... is it Christopher Hitchens? Was like someone asked him, when you're not debating religion or when you're not sort of shitting on religion, what do you like to do? And he said, oh... I like to gloat on the misfortunes of others.
What?
I think he was joking, but some people enjoy. Yeah, like they enjoy the failure of, you know, other people they don't like. They see someone stuff up and it kind of makes you feel good if you don't like that person. So, yeah, Ikigai is not always positive or healthy.
See, not to say that every activity we do has to be a productivity biohack, but I am wondering if Ikigai is about the present and optimizing for, seems to be joy in what you're doing, how do we also make sure then that we're still, maybe there's not an objectively right thing, but still doing things that are putting us on a track that's going forward?
Yeah, so that's a good point. So there's 2 points. It's fulfillment over happiness.
What's the distinction?
So we place a lot of emphasis on being happy and thinking happy is the ultimate goal. So I wouldn't say I'm happy at the moment. Like I'm not jumping for joy. I'm not in ecstasy. This... tease, it's sort of average quality. it's not the best tea, but it is fulfilling me. It's sort of quenching my thirst. You know, I feel pretty good. So the goal of Ikigai is not to be happy, but we can probably always find fulfillment even on our worst days or bad days. We can find some form of fulfillment, whether it's just a drink or a deep breath. So Ikigai is not the pursuit of happiness. We've got to be clear on that. It's more about life satisfaction, fulfillment. But it is this feeling that your life is moving forward. And so this is where it's tied to your perception of the future, and you have things to look forward to. So another aspect, or really how it's different to happiness, is this feeling of sort of anticipation, and that you either have things to look forward to, or you're working on goals that excite you and that are meaningful for you. So it's this feeling your life is moving forward in, I guess, the direction you want it to go.
Is it a binary? You either have it or you don't.
No, because it's... Well, actually, because it's something you feel...
Yeah.
Yeah, so, this is the irony of Ikigai. A lot of Japanese don't have it because Ikigai is tied to... Yeah, so this is these ironies of Japan. They have this incredible wisdom. They have these words that articulate a concept we understand, but we don't have a word for. Yet one of the most searched key words in relation to Ikigai is Ikigai Nai, meaning essentially no Ikigai in Japan. And yeah, look at Japan's work culture or their social conformity. They have a lot of stress and pressure. So a lot of Japanese don't feel Ikigai. You know, every day's just pressure, work. And they have all these unique social problems. You might have heard all these problems where they have extreme social withdrawal, where Japanese essentially lock themselves in their room for years. It's called hikikomori. That started in the 70s, and you have men in their mid-50s who have spent majority of their life locked in their sort of bedroom, almost like a delinquent teenager, sort of refusing to participate in society. So Japan has all these unique social problems that would suggest plenty of them lack ikigai because they lack this feeling of significance. They feel they don't have meaning or purpose to their life, and they don't have any strong social connections. Yet trying to participate in society for some of them is so uncomfortable or so hard, they'd rather stay at home. It's a huge problem. If you Google this word, you'll see all these documentaries, hikikomori. So hiku is to pull, and sort of komoru is to close in. And several, like at least 3 million Japanese live like this.
I'm still trying to wrap my head around it. If they don't want to participate in the society and they're almost locking themselves in the room and they would rather do that, is that not a form of ikigai?
That's ikigai as an extreme coping mechanism.
In what way?
It's not going to give them purpose. It's not going to give them, probably not a lot of life satisfaction. They're not going to be really connected. But at least they feel, to some degree, safe and in control. Yeah. So, I mean, it's so hard. Sometimes I think it's so easy to frame ikigai. It's like, it's what gives your life meaning. What makes life feel worth living. But then it can be a coping mechanism for some people. Or it can be the pursuit of an ambitious goal. For some people... who are not ambitious at all and they have no desire to achieve any goals, it can just be, I've got a friend who's single, about to turn 60, no real desire to achieve any goals, but I think out of all my friends, he seems to be the one who's most satisfied. And his ikigai is catching up. He organizes these boys' nights out, and it's this social element. It's banter, it's humor. And he loves these nights. That's his ikigai, catching up with his mates. And he's, he doesn't have the burdens of relationships, children, all these problems that come with, I guess, the complexity of raising a family and all that stuff. So, and he's probably got more control on what he can do each day. He can decide how to spend his time, less commitment. But, you know, at the same time, you could argue he might be missing out. He might be missing out on these meaningful roles and relationships, but he certainly doesn't feel that.
So I guess it almost, tell me if I'm wrong, maybe I'm jumping the gun, it almost seems like it's the art of doing, because you can either not start something and not have ikigai, and you can either accomplish something, but when you're not in pursuit of something, it almost feels like you don't have ikigai. But it's the track of almost wanting to do something or being on the track is what ikigai is.
Yes and no. So it is proactive. Like, yeah. It does require some form of action. And, I mean, there's actually Ikigai advisors now in Japan, and they help retirees transition from this work role to a new role in society. And they have three categories of Ikigai. One is like, I sort of have this sort of crazy spreadsheet on, well, not sort of chart and what it could be. But they have first person perspective, second and third. So first would be your hobbies, the things you would do by yourself. So hobbies, interests. Second is relational. So things you'd do with family, friends, playing sport together, going out. These are all sources of ikigai. And then the third is tied to society or community. Maybe you do some volunteer work. Maybe you take on a part-time job. Maybe you're on, I don't know, like a board for a local school. So there's these different dimensions. But each of them requires some sort of action or interaction. But in saying that, it can also be to some degree passive. Like, you know how sometimes you grab a coffee in the morning, you sit in front of the computer, you start to work, and then you notice your coffee's cold and you haven't even really had it. So it would be better to make time for your coffee, sit outside, be mindful, enjoy it, sip it slowly, feel the warmth, feel the taste. So that could be like a little way to start your day feeling a little bit of ikigai. It's just a mindful drinking of your coffee. And so it does require this, you know, this presence or awareness, like, oh, I'm sort of making the most of what I'm doing, or I'm at least making the most of what gives my life meaning, purpose, or fulfillment.
You know, it's funny. I was writing down notes yesterday or 2 days ago. I can't remember when it was. And my mate looks over my shoulder and he goes, "Oh, ikigai, isn't that the thing where you find the perfect career?" And I'm like, it's so funny because it seems like purpose nowadays, and I think this is why people confuse it so much, and with ikigai, why is everything to do with our career and money making?
Yeah, I know.
It's because I feel like you can, from what you're saying, ikigai is completely separate.
Yeah. So, you look, for a lot of people, their work is their ikigai, but they would not tie it to how much you earn or to even to like income's secondary to the work. So, okay, yeah, you want to get paid well, but a really good example of this is in Japan, most of their companies are small to medium. I think when we have this perception of Japan, we think of big companies like Sony or Toyota or whatnot. But apparently 99.7% of businesses in Japan are small to medium. And they've survived on this inheritance model, like the oldest son will take the business okay. over. Yeah, and that's been going on for generations. And so you have this company that, you know, might make fine, might make the, like, these beautiful bonsai scissors, or you have a company that makes the heads for calligraphy brushes, or they make tatami mats. And what's happening, this is like another problem, is because so many Japanese now move to cities and they take on roles, I guess, they want to pursue themselves. All these businesses don't have someone to inherit the business. And these are businesses that are in the black, they're making money, they've got clientele, they've got a good future ahead. And the owners don't want to sell them just for profit. And they have this concern, like, if I sell my company, I want to make sure whoever takes over is going to look after my clients, treat the business with respect. And so some would rather the business, just close the business, rather than sell it for, you know, a profit and have another nest egg. So Japanese care about quality, their relationships to their clients. But in the West, yeah, you know, we have this fixation on numbers, like, oh, I've got to earn $100,000 or, you know, $1,000,000. Usually ends with a perfect sort of set of zeros afterwards, and we live beyond our needs, so we're sort of spending more. More is never enough. And then go online, you have people taking photos of, you know, just wealth. Like, I'm surrounded with wealth. And yeah, so we're conditioned. Obviously, we're conditioned to earn money, to spend money. Capitalism, keep buying stuff, buy the latest phones, buy the latest brands. It's almost tribal, yeah, some brands. But a real distinction between purpose and, I guess, this idea of ikigai. So ikigai has all these... it's multidimensional, and we could say it has all these ideas of positive psychology. And when we talk about purpose in the context of ikigai, we're actually talking about sense of purpose. And this came from this mother of ikigai. I like to call her the mother of ikigai, this pioneering researcher, Miyako Kamiya. She said it's a sense of purpose. And so you can find a sense of purpose in doing small things well, in pursuing your role with a sense of purpose, whether that's podcast host or being a father or being just a good neighbor or a good customer, like you support a local cafe, gives you a sense of purpose. We relate purpose to success in the West and how much success you have, and we have this almost like all or nothing attitude. We have to have great success Or
it doesn't fulfill a purpose. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's kind of delusional, because we usually know once we achieve what we hope to achieve, it's either not as good as we hoped, or it just doesn't last. That feeling of elation, or, yeah, you know, I did it. A week later, it's like, oh, okay, I've got the urge to do something else now. I need to keep going. So this is why it's so important to have intrinsic value in your life, where there's no sort of outcome. The outcome is just to be present, to enjoy the moment, and to kind of feel a sense of purpose in what you do or the relationships you have.
And I think that's the main distinction. I had a conversation with Dr. Anne-Laure LeCompte a while ago, and her entire motto is, oh, she's brilliant, and her entire motto is that we should experiment with activities based on our intrinsic feelings and not external goals, because once we start dealing with external goals, we get almost put in a prison of our own
making.
Yeah. Of our own making, exactly. Yeah, and yeah, yeah. I think that's actually what maybe Japan has got that the West doesn't right now in terms of the definition of ikigai. It's the fact that we're also focused on... And I've got the problem as well. I'm not going to sit here with my up on a pedestal. I've got the problem as well, to be honest. Like, as a kid in college, the one thing you're always looking for or talking about is, oh, that kid's got that internship. That kid's going to make XYZ money, that kid's gonna make six figures. And it's like we almost tie that to our sense of belonging or our sense of being.
Yeah, it's how we value ourselves and others. And if I said to you, hey, two business meetings, I've got a friend who's made 10 billion, you know, 10 million. I've got a friend who's just starting. Who would you want to talk to? You'd obviously want to talk to the one who you have the perceptions, you know, more successful. But I mean, a really good example of this sense of purpose and also, I guess, success in Japan would be looking at their crafts.
What do you
craftsmen
mean?
Or craftspeople.
Mm.
And that they have this idea of pursuing or achieving perfection, knowing they'll never get it, but rather than thinking, oh, well, near enough's good enough, they just keep trying. And so you have these craftsmen who are, you know, into their 80s, still pursuing their craft. And if you attempt to compliment them and say, my God, your work is exquisite, clearly you're a master at this, they'll instantly go, no, 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 you know, I'm still not there, I'm still working on it. Whereas in the West, we're quick to receive, you know, compliments, just, you know, even if we're lucky, you know, so, or like, I've got this great idea, I'm going to start a business, and we go out and celebrate it, you know, so yeah.
Is
Japanese,
it not dangerous though?
Sorry?
Is that not slightly dangerous though?
What is?
Like to not celebrate, to always be on this track of almost becoming better, that you almost forget to celebrate that pursuit itself.
Yeah, it's interesting because I used to struggle with it. I really couldn't understand. I'd have these genuine compliments to Japanese friends or people, and they'd always get rejected. And I thought, well, this is really strange. Like, because, you know, I would almost argue saying, no, you're good. You're good at playing the piano. I'm making a compliment and you're denying it. And I couldn't get it, but sort of eventually I just got it. It's like Japanese always kind of feel there's room for improvement. And it is a type of social conditioning. But in the case of these craftsmen, they really love what they're pursuing. And you hear these stories about, I think it's Jiro Dreams of Sushi, one of these documentaries, how he, you know, he goes off and gets this incredible award and, you know, receives the award, and by the end of the afternoon he's back at his restaurant, back at work, because, you know, work and serving the customer is more important than, I guess, an award from a stranger. So they just value, they place value on, I guess, the pursuit of craft and respecting it. Whereas, yeah, you know, we like to celebrate our wins, which I think is good. I think it's healthy. So yeah, maybe for me, it's when I work with people, it's like finding this balance of, be careful of the ego, but also, yeah, you want to feel good about your growth or your success. But I mean, Japanese are so considerate. Like if they have really good news and they've achieved something, if they're in a group, out of consideration for others, so that they don't feel bad, they won't share it. Whereas we would, because we probably assume
it's the first thing on our mind.
Would,
yeah.
But we'd also assume our friends would be happy for us. But we're not going to think, oh, yeah, I've landed this contract, but I won't share it because my mates are going to feel bad. We wouldn't even think about that. Yeah, we'd just go, hey, I've got some great news. So, yeah, we're sort of getting off the track of Ikigai, but it is this idea of, for some, their Ikigai is this pursuit of craft, and they'll do it to the day they die, and they're not looking for accolades. It's just they love their craft, and they love to serve their customer. And so rather than making a lot of money, they would just rather do the work, because the work itself is intrinsically meaningful. And, yeah, the idea of getting awards or getting a slap on the back or getting recognized just doesn't really matter.
I get it. It's almost like their sense of accomplishment is defined by their self-perspective, not by the validation they get from others, which I think actually can be very healthy.
Yeah.
So, but with, if that's their ikigai, in terms of, I know you said ikigai is not a place, but then how do we, what are the questions we can constantly ask ourselves to get ikigai now?
Well, ikigai can be a place in the context of, if you have a place where you have a sense of belonging, and there's kind of two ideas to this, it could be a physical location, your favorite cafe, a park, maybe where you grew up as a child and you go back there and you have this nostalgia and you feel good and you feel this sense of comfort and you start to breathe slowly and you reminisce. That can be a source of ikigai, or a social niche where you're, you know, you're needed, respected, loved, and you have a role in that niche, even if it's just being the fun, playful guy. That is where you would feel ikigai quite intensely. So it's felt, you know, in all these different ways when you're, you know, when you're relaxing by yourself and you have this sense of, you know, room and there's no stress, or you realize you're making progress with a hobby and you have this sort of little breakthrough and you have this sense of satisfaction and you feel your life is moving forward. Or you feel it, you know, maybe in your work, you feel like, oh, my work matters. It matters to people. I mean, there's nothing worse than a job where you know what you do does not matter. And you just think, why am I here? And the opposite's true. When you do work that's fulfilling, it impacts others. You get some sense of more recognition rather than validation. Like people go, oh, man, you really helped me today. I appreciate it. You're going to feel good. So, yeah, we feel it. So I guess if you want to feel it now, if you're asking, oh, how can I feel ikigai now? It's like, ask the question, what matters to you or who matters to you? And then spend time with that person or spend time with that whatever it is. If it's, you know, playing guitar or, you know, if it is this goal to succeed in business and you're wanting to pursue that and you feel it's meaningful. But yeah, it's so crucial that we be present. And this is something I've really sort of begun to realize. We have to be so aware and present, because most of the time we're in this delusion of internal conversation and we're regretting something or beating ourselves up or we're worried about something. And to take ourselves out of that, I think we either have, you know, journaling, some form of journaling that works for you, or maybe some sort of mindful activity, whether it's meditation or walking. But I mean, you can always do, I mean, I probably shouldn't say this, but you know, both my parents died of cancer. It was really unpleasant and bad. So if I ever think life's shitty or hard and I don't feel ikigai, I just remind myself, well, yeah, I'm actually very fortunate. I'm healthy. I'm alive. Incredible time to be living. You know, this technology is connecting us. And 20 years ago, wouldn't be happening. So it's also appreciating the abundance we have. And maybe that's the problem. We have so much abundance of so many things that it's like it's too much.
It's hard to hold in your gratitude. Yeah.
And we have this, it's like the paradox of choices. Everywhere you go somewhere to buy, like Netflix, it's so hard to choose a show now. You go shopping, you're trying to buy a craft beer now. It's like, what do I buy? This stress of consumerism. So it's also this idea of, I already have enough. That's another Japanese concept of like there is this idea of yo-yu, where you have enough, or utori, this sense of space. You see Japanese value space in architecture, in garden design, in music, or even in conversations. Like, we have this idea of awkward silences in a conversation. Yeah, like, oh, I need to say something. Japan, they have this idea of comfortable silences where nothing needs to be said, especially if it's already understood. If we're looking at a beautiful sunset, or we're eating delicious food, we don't need to go, oh, this sushi is amazing, or we don't need to rant on about how beautiful something is. We can just be present and quiet so that everyone enjoys it, sort of in this peace and calm. So it's all these, yeah, it's all these things together that make up ikigai.
You know, it's very interesting because your version of peace is actually very similar to, I just read the Almanac of Naval Ravikant, and he has a definition of happiness that blew my mind, because he basically says that the happy mood should be our default. We tend to look for things to be happy about, but almost if you reverse it and you reverse engineer the definition, it's almost like, well, if you have nothing to be actually inherently sad about, you should just be happy. And I think we link happiness with this one extra point from our current mood, which is just neutral or actually sad because we don't have anything going for us. But instead, why don't you just go, hey, you have nothing bad going for you. That is the form of peace or happiness you have in your life.
I love that idea. And I also can expand on that. I was interviewing a Japanese researcher who'd done a lot of research on ikigai and forest bathing.
Yeah.
And yeah, he has 4 children. So he has had an older child, and then he had he had triplets. All with them with 2 of them with severe disabilities. So life's changed forever. And when they were younger, if one of them got sick, they all got sick and they would just be all crying at night. And he told me, like, you know, yeah, I haven't slept for months, like, properly. And every night, if they start crying, I have to hold them and stand up. And I will probably look back on this and I could think that was a happy time. Like, it was probably the happiest moment in my time. Even though, you know, he's sort of dead to the world, he's sleep deprived, but he can frame it as in, I'm holding my baby who needs me. And I'm sort of this tenderness, this love. And so we can kind of frame happiness if we sort of realize there's nothing really bad in this moment, even for him, while, you know, he's sort of sleep deprived and dealing with a sick baby. Yet some people get so upset over small things. They get the wrong order in a restaurant and they're abusive, or we just don't appreciate anything. We're given something and we don't like it. And so, you know, this idea of the default is maybe you are happy. You just, perhaps you don't know it, or you have the conditions to be happy and you're just not appreciating it because, I guess, yeah, we, I don't know, maybe we've been brainwashed into thinking our lives have to be perfect, like, all the time.
And we're also so, like, I'm, at least from my perspective, now that I'm thinking about it, I'm also, the problems I have that make me sad are someone's end desires. Like, I have, I was speaking to Tommy Hawkyard last week. We did this whole episode about how there's a young men crisis going on. And I thought, well, something that was really interesting is, we live in a reality that objectively has never truly been better. We eat better than the kings from 200 years ago. We have the internet. Imagine trying to explain that to someone. but yet, subjectively, our capacity as a society to at least our perspective on our current well-being has never been lower. And we did this whole study about how young men's suicide rates are up, young women's mental illness rates are up. And this, there's this interesting almost paradox where our reality has never truly been better, but yet our subjective reality has never truly been worse. And it's almost like the privileges that we have sometimes can overwhelm us.
Yeah, yeah. It's clearly goes back to this abundance. We sort of drowning in it, and then we don't have any kind of meaningful challenge. And that meaningful challenge has become what we talked about before, success in work. And I mean, it ties to what we were, you know, this idea of, I talked to you about through the email, like this idea of rolefulness. Like, if you think about what gives your life meaning, purpose, it's some form of role. Yeah, we have all these roles, even if we don't know it. Like, we both have the role of son, which we probably wouldn't consider, you know, a role, but yeah, you can be a caring son. You can check in with your parents. You can express gratitude, and that sort of becomes a role rather than just thinking, oh, son, daughter, parents are just relationships. So I think there's this severe lack of meaningful role for all these young people. We're not having this idea of meaningful challenge where we grow and learn and have frustration that then leads to some form of insight or learning and then growth, where life is too, there's too much ease, there's this abundance, yet we're not sharing, we're not engaging in meaningful discussions. Everything's very superficial, and we kind of have no roles that are meaningful in life. And how many people hate going to work? How many people? I think someone used to say, "Oh, everyone hates Sunday night," but I think some people hate Saturday night because all Sunday they're just going to be depressed dreading because it, they know they have to go to work on Monday. You know, So if you hate your job that much, it's a role, yeah. And then this social fabric doesn't exist where we're connecting, and we're all on screens. You know, even my family, we're usually on screens in separate rooms, and it's become the norm. And yeah, technology has all these incredible benefits, but it's also changed how we relate, communicate, behave. And yeah, I mean, I really struggle going to restaurants and dealing with people who are on their phones. It's like, for God's sake. And now we have to use them. We have to use them to order. You know, you have to use a QR code now. And the whole idea of greetings, having some conversation, and then thanking staff. Some places you don't even do that anymore. You walk in, do the QR code, the food's delivered, you've paid, and you leave. And these small interactions, these, I think they're called weak ties, are really important to our mental well-being, that we have some sort of light engagement with strangers. Is important because I guess we realize all these people around us are not threats. They're friends. We have these positive little interactions that make us feel human and connected, and we're eliminating them for convenience. And it blows my mind. It's like, oh man.
Yeah.
No wonder we have all these problems.
this idea of rawfulness is really, really good, because I think what I typically struggle with as well is I like to, at least when I think of my role per se, I almost see the role as, all right, how can I show up as a better human? And that can really put me off, because when I'm doing something, it's almost like I'm not fully focused on that one sole thing, because my role is a better human. But if I were to go, hey, for the next 30 minutes, like you said, I'm going to call up my parents, how can I be a better son right now? Well, that's just a tunnel vision thing. You've got one direction, and it gives you almost peace of mind that you can fulfill this role. But even when you get on the call with your parents and you're thinking, hey, how can I be a better human? You may show up as the best son, but that still doesn't fulfill your direction of being a better human.
Yeah, so the secret of rolefulness, I mean, so it's this, I want to give credit to Professor Daiki Kato, who's like a good friend now, and we co-wrote this book together. And yeah, he coined this idea of rolefulness, and you kind of understand it as soon as you hear it. Oh, rolefulness, it's like this sense of role satisfaction. And so his theory basically was, yeah, we do have these significant roles in life, but we can have this general sense of rolefulness in all our interactions. And it involves three things: greeting people, having conversations, and expressing gratitude. And it's quite easy to think, is that it? Like, that's not much. But think back the last time when you were with a group and someone in the group greeted everyone but you.
Oh, it's horrible.
And you start to think, they don't like me. I've just met them. What's going on? And you could be thinking about it for hours afterwards. And then later, you know, you find out they didn't even, you know, it's just a misunderstanding. But you go through this minefield of, they don't like me, and what have prick. I done? And they're what a prick. Yeah. This anger. And then, yeah, meaningful conversation, friendly chat feels good. You have this friendly chat with a stranger, feels good. And then there is something about thanking and being thanked. It feels right to thank someone. You know when you should thank someone. And when you are thanked and it's genuine, it makes your day. And I was thinking about this, and I realized there was this Vietnamese cafe near my house a few months ago. It opened a few years ago. And I remember going in, and the lady who owned it was just kind of abrupt, like, what do you want? And making the barmy and friendly but superficial, or just sort of serving me. And I never went back again, even though it was really close to my house. About 3 months ago, someone took over the business. They changed, you know, the decor a bit, and went in, and this like, hi, I'm Coco. Who are you? I'm Nick. Hey, Nick, how are you going? She's always remembered my name. So every time I go in there, always get a greeting, always have a conversation, and she always thanks me. And I go there 2 times a week, 3 times a week, simply because I guess we'd call it rolefulness. She's not just serving me. She's not just making the food. She's sort of asking about how I am, greeting me properly. We have this chat, and now I want to support her. So it has this incredible impact. Like, but we don't do these things now because of what I said before. You know, QR codes are sort of taking over restaurants, or we're getting lazy, or we're so used to screens. And now you have people who have phobias of even just meeting people, greeting people, or having conversations. So, yeah, this idea of general rolefulness is something really easy to implement and is going to make you feel better. Then there is specific rolefulness, where you you have a role as a podcast host, and there's probably a certain type of way you intuitively want to do this based on your values. Yeah, so the way you sent me an email, the way you communicate, the way you prepare, you were very detailed saying, we're using Riverside, and have, here are my questions or ideas. So I know you care about your role, and maybe think, oh, this guy cares about what he does.
Oh, thanks, mate.
You know, he's expressing his... Essentially, you're expressing your values through this role, yeah?
Hmm.
And I get to know who you are, and I get to know your values because of the way you perform this role. Sort of intuitively. I'm not thinking, oh, that's his role is to be... Yeah. So that's... And that's what we do. And then we know, we intuitively know when we violate our values in a role.
Yeah.
So a really good example would be... Like, if I flew off the handle at my son, probably be okay now because he's 21. But, you know, if I suddenly, for some reason, just flipped out and started screaming and yelling at him, I would deeply regret it the next day or even immediately because I think, oh, the one person I love the most, I've lost control. I can't take it back. This moment, you know, it'll be a memory. And I wasn't myself. I wasn't the man I wanted to be in the context of the role of a father. And, yeah, you know when you violate your values, you really feel horrible or you feel like I've let myself down, I've let him down, and I'm not that person, yet I became that person in that moment of stress or whatever. So, yeah, it's this idea of living in alignment with your values, but in the context of role. And some roles will have different values. And the way you express those values even evolve and change over time. So when my son was younger, the way I expressed love was really different. We would hold hands, tickle, you know, piggybacking, kind of playfulness. Now that he's 21, it's banter and it's jokes and it's meaningful conversation. So we have these important roles, and they're specific, and we make them, I guess, unique or special by expressing our values through these roles.
Do you think we can manifest ourselves into a role? And I'll give you an example. So growing up, I fortunately had like the reputation of being the very, oh, Rishi's the nice little kid, the kind one, right?
And I can imagine.
Thanks, mate. Yeah, I'll try my best. Then after I started growing up a bit more, like even especially my first year in college, I'm in my second year now, I'm acting like I'm 80, but in my first year of college, like I felt almost disheartened because I felt like I wasn't living up to the reputation. And maybe this podcast even came out of that I'm trying to fulfill that role of being a kind person again. But because that role was almost given to me, I'm now trying my best to uphold the standards of that role. So even though maybe at one point I lost that role, I'm maybe trying to manifest myself back into it. Do you think that's still like a possible route?
I mean, I think you're just trying to be the person you want to be in this certain context. If the podcast is a result of your intuition, like you had this inner voice saying, you know, Rishi, do the podcast, or you should do the podcast, or you had this urge to do it because you felt I can express myself, I want to have these conversations, I want to kind of grow through this, then that is you kind of almost subconsciously creating a role, because you're not sitting down thinking, I'm going to create a new role in my life. Let's see, I'll be a podcast host.
Yeah.
You kind of thought, oh, I want to do something meaningful. I want to, I have this urge to do a podcast and I want to have interesting conversations with people and learn. And maybe, you know, maybe you're inspired by someone. But I mean, I had the same. I started my podcast, so my whole business started from a podcast. So it was a passion project, and I saw all this stuff on Ikigai, knowing it was all BS, all romanticized, all fake. And I felt this sense of, almost this sense of, like, you know, this is wrong. Someone needs to do something about it. And it took me like a year and a half for me to think, okay, well, maybe I can, because I had this little voice saying, oh, well, why don't you do something about it? Like, well, me, you know, I'm not Japanese and I don't know what Ikigai is. All I know, it's not the Venn diagram. So I had to listen to my true self or my better self and then believe in it and think, okay, well, maybe I can start a podcast and I'll interview Japanese academics who can speak English. And it started with this sort of intuition, thinking I should do it. And at the time, I guess I was crafting or creating this role. I just didn't know. And then, yeah, you send the first email, you get the first podcast, you have the first guest, you do another one, and before you know it, oh, I have this new role, this sort of unofficial ambassador of Ikigai, trying to share with the world what Ikigai is, respectfully, accurately. And yeah, it sort of turned into a bigger role. It's sort of a business. I have this business, so I'm not just a podcast host, I'm a coach, I'm a facilitator. But I created it, which is kind of fascinating. So I think the answer is yes, you can create this unique role. It's just you've got to listen to your intuition when it taps you on the shoulder. That's so crucial. Like, it's so life-changing. And most of the time, we dismiss it because we don't believe in ourselves, or we make excuses, it's too hard, or we pick up the phone and we look at something and it's gone. And it's a tragedy, because that intuition is whatever you believe in. It could be a guardian angel, it could be God, it could be the universe conspiring to help you. But that's these moments when your life, the trajectory of your life changes. You finally make a decision, I'll do a podcast. And you find a way. You know, even though it's challenging, you research, you get the microphone, you get the software, you find the guest. But it doesn't stop, you know, you kind of keep going. And, you know, here we are talking to each other today. And that probably would have been very unlikely had you not started your role and I had, you know, not started mine.
Yeah. And that's not to say that there's never moments of dissatisfaction or pain within our roles, right?
Oh, yeah. There's plenty of challenge, plenty of frustration. But that's, I mean, if it was too easy, you wouldn't do it.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
I mean, this is my favorite part of being a podcast host, speaking. I'm telling you right now, like, I enjoy doing it to a certain extent, but editing the podcast, doing all that shenanigans is not the best part. Like, God, there's times when I'm like, why am I even doing this? Like, you know, but at the end of the day, I was speaking to my mate about this. Every single time I hit post and I almost have that moment, I'm going, I'm a podcast host. Oh, it's like a relief off your shoulders, and it's such a nice feeling, like the dopamine you get. So it's all worth it at the end.
Yeah, this is why we go back to intrinsic motivation or intrinsic factors, because you know, I'm assuming you're not making any money from doing this.
Absolutely not. If anything, I've lost all my money.
But
yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I used to edit my own, and I can feel your pain, and it was like, oh. And if I had a guest to at every third word, I would, I would think, oh, this is going to be a long, long afternoon. But yeah, you're right. You finish it, you post it, and a neuroscientist, his name's Ken Moggi. He's like the celebrity neuroscientist in Japan, and he wrote a book on Ikigai. It's called The Little Book of Ikigai, which people should check out. And I had him on the podcast, and we had a great conversation, and then I had him back. And he, you know, we were talking about Ikigai, and he said, you know, Nick, most people won't tell you that they enjoyed your podcast or benefited from their podcast. They'll listen to it, they'll get some value out of it, and, you know, they just move on. So it's sort of the same for you, Rishi. There'll be all these people who are getting great value out of this podcast, and we don't always, you know, hear about it, but you kind of know. I think you can know that, some people will get some benefit out of this conversation. And yeah, it's definitely worth, you know, all the effort. And it's, you never know. You know, people might listen to some of your episodes years from now, and it's going to help them.
Yeah, that's a really helpful way of saying it, you know. Because I always tell myself, I'm like, all right, well, this episode hasn't done as well as this episode, but in the future, when maybe the following gets a bit better or bigger, they're going to come back. So it's all for a time and a place.
Yeah, don't get, you know, what do they call them? Vanity matrix or vanity statistics. Don't get stuck on...
Yeah, I'm not smart enough to understand that, mate. I don't know what that is. Yeah. I don't know what's a vanity matrix?
And vanity matrix are number of downloads or number of views.
Ah, okay, okay. Gotcha.
That's another thing we worry about. These things that probably don't matter, you know, like, this episode got so many downloads and this one didn't, and I thought it was a better episode. Podcasts are interesting because you kind of record them and then you just got to release them and see what happens.
Love it. Nick, it's been an absolute pleasure. I'm so gassed I had this. And I'll go scream at my dad for showing me that book with the dusty Venn diagram. I'll put him in a slice.
Get him this book.
I'll get him. And I'll get him role for this as well. You know? Nick, I always ask my lovely guest, the same question, which is, what is the best advice you've ever received?
The best advice I've ever received, this came from that neuroscientist, Ken Moggi, and he said, you know, when you're having a difficult conversation with someone, you don't always have to disagree, you don't always have to prove your point. Even if it's not a difficult conversation. And he said, you never know the alienation or devastation of an offhand comment and what it can cause someone. So try to be mindful of what you say to others and... It relates to, he has five pillars of Ikigai, and this is related to this idea of harmony and sustainability. And he's sort of saying this is not really about the environment, it's just about relationships. So always be mindful of what you say to others, because, an offhand comment can really alienate someone and you wouldn't even know. So that's sort of the best advice, be mindful of, just what you say to others. That really resonated with me.
And I'm going to remember the three things: the greeting, the conversing, and the gratitude.
Oh, yeah.
Come on.
So I can do that right now, and thank you. So thank you, Rishi. It's been a joy to be on your podcast.
It's an honor on both my end, mate. It's truly a pleasure. I love having these conversations. Nick, where can my lovely audience find you, and what is next?
People can find me at ikigaitribe.com. And what's next? I guess I'm sort of diving into the world of doing retreats, Ikigai retreats in Japan. So that's sort of the next meaningful goal I'm working on. Yeah.
If I'm up there, I gotta get a little link. Yeah.
We'll probably catch up once you come here to Australia. So looking forward to that.
Love it. Thank you so much, Nick.
My pleasure. Thank you, mate.